Hello, I'm from Down Under. Way Down Under. Some people call me Satan. Others call me Beelzebub or Mephistopheles. But you can simply call me Lucy. It's short for Lucifer. This is another hot show. It's number 0666. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0666. Coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Mark Goldsmith is the founder of Getting Out and Staying Out, a nonprofit organization that helps incarcerated youth follow the right path when they get out of jail. How did this all start for this retired cosmetics executive?
I really had no intention of doing this. My wife suggested that I do something in New York City called Principal for the Day. And she said I should be Principal for the Day. I said, that sounds like fun. Go into the New York City school system, talk to New York City kids about their future. I'm a bit of a wise guy, so I went down to this organization. I said, listen, give me a tough school. I don't want to go to a really nice school like where my kids went. I want inner city school. Well, guess where they sent me? They sent me to Rikers Island.
Bruce Olof Solheim, author of the new graphic novel, Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter. This character is actually a spin-off from his Snark 2 graphic novel.
One of the characters in a couple of the stories in Snark 2 was Dr. Jekyll, Dr. Henna Jekyll, who's a anthropologist from Cleveland State University. And she gets hooked up with Snark and the Cosmic Staff in Snark 2. This is a spin-off. I love the character, so now she has her own comic. It's a little different take. The style of it is different. I have a different artist. There's still history there. There's comedy. There's science fiction, fantasy, all that stuff. But it's from a, kind of from a female perspective.
Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com shares the story of the time in 1952 when it made news that UFOs didn't attack Seattle.
1952 was an especially busy year for flying saucers. A lot of sightings, hundreds a month. The biggest one being in Washington, D.C., going over the Capitol in July. That was a pretty big deal, on radar and everything. So lots of stuff going on about flying saucers. And so when a major blast occurred over Seattle one early morning in May, and people did not blame flying saucers, that made news.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0666 was Satan. Need I say anything more? He kind of insisted on doing this particular number, and I wasn't about to do anything to get on his bad side. Dare I say thank you for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Now, let's get right to the stuff. Investigators in Vancouver, Washington, looking into the sexual exploitation of children, uncovered another nasty habit of Stephen Sharp, a night manager at an Arby's restaurant there.
Arby's, we have the meat.
Oh, hold off on the tagline. You're not going to be proud of this one. On May 10th, Sharp admitted that he had downloaded and distributed child pornography. As icky, disgusting, and vile as that is, you better buckle up to hear the rest of this story. After conducting a search of his digital devices, police also found a video of him urinating into a container of milkshake mix at Arby's.
Nature can be really disappointing sometimes.
Tell me about it. He confessed that he had done so at least twice for sexual gratification.
Okay, that's ridiculous.
Sharp said it would have been added to another bag of mix and used during the next shift to make shakes for customers.
Arby's, you are making a mistake.
Officers are seeking people who might have ordered a shake on October 30th or 31st of last year and still have a receipt. Who still has a receipt for a fast food restaurant from last year? Anyway, Sharp is facing multiple charges and is now eating institutional food at the Clark County Jail. Wow. An alleged child pornographer who peed into a milkshake machine at Arby's. You know, when word gets out about this in Gen Pop, how much unwanted attention do you think he's going to receive while locked up? Oh, he can beg forgiveness when asked by fellow inmates if he's going to be a good boy and repeat his answer 10 times.
Yes, 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 yep, yes, yes.
But it won't help. 54-year-old Don LaShawn LaPrade really wanted to get away from cops on May 18th in Martin County, Florida. LaPrade allegedly intentionally hit a sheriff's office vehicle as she tried to evade a traffic stop. Next, she drove up to 100 miles per hour, hitting another patrol car and a civilian truck, injuring people inside, and motioned to officers that she had a gun. But the real coup de grace came when officers finally caught up to her and she threw a fake snake at them. LaPrade was booked and held on $90,000 bond.
Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes?
Asps. Very dangerous.
Yes, she was just making an asp of herself. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Kingsland, Arkansas, about 70 miles south of Little Rock, is the birthplace of Johnny Cash. And the town has honored him with a silhouette of the man in black on its water tower. But when Betty Graham, water office manager, arrived at her office early on May 11th, she noticed what she first thought was a leak from the tower. Later, she realized a sharpshooter had hit the water tank at Cash's sweet spot, creating the illusion that the famous singer was relieving himself. Well, the tower, that was gushing out about 30,000 gallons of water per day for a short time, became a bit of a tourist attraction, said one local.
It was a long shot. I have killed deer, but not that far away.
In the meantime, comments on a local Facebook page range from would be a better tourist attraction than Old Faithful to someone here knows who did this. I hope they'll come forward and turn the vandal in, said our previous local friend who saw the humor in the shooting.
Whoever shot it out should have to pay for it.
Oh, someone will pay for it. 38-year-old Timothy Sled has been arrested and charged with criminal mischief and impairing the operation of a vital public utility. If convicted of both felonies, he could face up to 16 years behind bars. The irony of that sentence is, while in prison, he probably would like a concert visit from Johnny Cash. Too bad he's already dead. Remember when Johnny did a live concert at Folsom Prison?
My mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
Now Timothy Sled can say that he shot a man in Kingsland just to watch him pee. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program. From May the 4th to June 4th, it's National Returning Youth Month, which is meant to bring awareness to young adults coming back into society after incarceration. New York City businessman Mark Goldsmith, who is retired from the international cosmetics industry, is the founder of the nonprofit organization called Getting Out and Staying Out. He joins us via Zoom from New York. Hi, Mark.
How are you, sir?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for doing this. So how did someone in the cosmetics industry find interest in this particular story of bringing back youth and youth awareness and getting them back into society after incarceration?
It was quite serendipitous. I really had no intention of doing this, Peter. My wife suggested that I do something in New York City called Principal for the Day. He said, you're great with young kids. Why don't you do it? This is actually, I had left the cosmetic industry. I had then entrepreneured a bartering and trading company for 8 years, and I was running that. And she said, I should be principal for the day. I said, that sounds like fun. Go into the New York City school system, talk to New York City kids about their future. I'm a bit of a wise guy. So I went down to this organization. I said, listen, give me a tough school. I don't want to go to a really nice school like where my kids went. I want inner city school. Well, guess where they sent me? They sent me to Rikers Island, because on Rikers Island, there is a GED school, at that time called the Horizon Academy. Now it's the East River Academy. And that's where I was sent. So off to Rikers Island I went. And it reminded me of an incident that happened to me, not a pleasant one. I was not a great student. I went to Penn State for a couple of years. Dean and I had a meeting. He decided one of us should leave Penn State. It's not going to be me, young man. So off Penn State I left and went in the Navy for 2 years. And then when I got out of the Navy, last week in the Navy, the ship came into New York Harbor. I took one look at it. I said, this is better than Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which is where I grew up. Went back to Johnstown. My dad got me a job in New York. The day before I was leaving, I went out with my buddies. We got drunk, and I ran an accident and ran into a cop car and got myself arrested and jailed. I can still hear the door closing behind me. I said, oh, boy. So my father came down and bailed me out, and that was my experience, my jail experience up to the time I walked into Rikers Island, but it did kind of remind me of it. I walked into a classroom, Peter, these young men, and I said to myself, I got to get their attention. So I decided to talk to them about Tupac Shakur and Kobe Bryant. I figured I'd let them know the white dude did know something from their world. And they thought that was kind of interesting. And the correction officers were amazed that these guys actually sat and listened to me for 3 hours. So after we chat a little bit about rap and a little bit about basketball, I asked them what they wanted to do for the rest of their lives, and nobody had a clue. They were going back to the corner, sell more drugs, whatever. So I said, I'll tell you what, guys, I'm going to do an analogy for you. Analogies where you match two different things. So I'm going to match General Motors to a drug cartel. I'm going to teach you the corporate world, and you're going to teach me the drug business. I said, so in this corporate world, there are people called salesmen who sell the cars. Any of you guys know how to sell? Oh, we know how to sell, MG. I said, okay. There's also some guy who takes care of the money. You got a guy who takes care of the money? Yeah, we got a guy who takes care of the money. Then we have another group of people who select who's going to be in the gang. You got people like that? I said, yeah, that's called personnel. And I went through the corporation and placed each of them in a corporation based on their interest level. And they thought that was fascinating. And that's how I kept their interest for 3 hours. And I went back to work.
That is fascinating.
One year later, I go back to principal for the day. And I said, well, where are you sending me this year? He said, you're going back to Rikers Island. They loved you on Rikers. I figured somebody loves me on Rikers. I'm going back. So back to Rikers I went and met Gloria Ortiz, who was the principal who had asked that I be sent back. And I asked her if she was interested in me coming in more often. She said, absolutely. So that was the beginning. Now, Rikers Island is really mostly for detainees. You get arrested, you go to Rikers Island, and you sit there till your trial or you take a plea. And so these guys were there short term, but they were either going to go to an upstate prison or get put on probation. And I started seeing them there until one day, one guy actually beat his case and he was going to be out in the community. And I said, what are you going to do now? He said, yeah, probably go back and sell more drugs. And I said, why don't you meet me at Starbucks? So we met at Starbucks, and that was the beginning of the actual working with these guys outside the jail in the community.
When you first went through this whole process, and again, you're talking about going to Rikers, where, let's be honest, some of the less fortunate people in society growing up, never mind just behind bars, are there behind bars. You mentioned your story about you getting drunk and slamming into a police car. Was this a situation of there, but for the grace of God go I, and also the disparity between, you know, you coming from, let's be honest, a white neighborhood, a white background, and these inner city kids.
That's what it's all about. I mean, these guys had been dealt a bad deck of cards. They came from the worst neighborhoods in New York. I came from a middle class neighborhood in a small town in western Pennsylvania. Family life was limited. There was just There weren't any male role models. When I asked them who their guardian was, many times it wasn't their mother, it was their grandmother. And here they were without any guidance, any help whatsoever, let alone somebody who could bail them out. Peter, in the 15 years I worked there, not a single guy bailed out because of the bail system, which is something that needs to be rectified, because bail is really set for people like you and I, not for these young kids who can't afford it.
Okay, so we have just a few minutes left here. I've got to find out exactly what getting out and staying out is all about. When did you start the organization, and what exactly does your organization do?
It's over 15 years ago. There are three E's. The three E's of getting out and staying out are education, which is obvious. Get your GED. You can do it. You can go at night. I got my undergraduate degree at night working full time. And then I got a master's degree at night also working full time. So what we have in the community is a GED facility where they can get their high school equivalency. Second is employment. So I started the job readiness curriculum, and it was 2 weeks in duration. You had to go through several classes that I set up. I had people come in and teach them various things. And so they understood what was a resume, what was a cover letter. And at the end of that 2 weeks, they had to schedule an appointment with me, with my secretary. They had to show up in a shirt and tie and go through a rigorous interview before I would send them out on a job. Now, the third E, and I'm glad we have time for it. My wife's a PhD social worker, and she said to me, only hire social workers with a master's degree who can do some form of therapy, because these guys have been through trauma. So every social worker who has ever worked at getting out and staying out has a master's degree in social work. So what's it all about? The three E's: education, employment, and emotional well-being. I then set out the book. Is really part-time, it's a memoir, but it's also a how to start a not-for-profit.
And your book, by the way, is From Madison Avenue to Rikers Island, right?
Exactly. The Making of a Social Entrepreneur. In other words, how do you take a corporate guy? And what I'm hoping is other people will read the book and make a decision of perhaps getting involved in the not-for-profit world. And the way you do that is you volunteer. You volunteer at a place that you think the people have a situation where you might be of some help.
Now, nothing is 100% as far as success rate is concerned. So getting out and staying out, what would you
very
say?
Very good. Very good question. The recidivism rate on Rikers Island was over 60%. My recidivism rate was under 15%. And it wasn't what I was doing. It was what they were doing. What we did is we gave them a path. But then we also held their feet to the fire. This was not a free ride. To get into the program on Rikers Island, you had to write an essay. I want to be in your program because I agree to continue in school. And then when they get out, there's more writing when they apply for a job. How do you do a resume and how do you do a cover letter? So there's intense training and they have to agree to do it. It's not a free ride. The ball is in their court to do what we counsel them for. We have a board of directors. And these guys act as coaches and mentors to the guys also.
It sounds like you're doing an amazing service. And it's a model for, I would assume, other communities, other states, other prison systems. Have you been branching out beyond Rikers?
I have not. We have not. In fact, Rikers is going through a transformation right now. I think it's probably going to take a receivership and maybe turn it over to the feds for a short period of time, because the drugs and the violence has gotten excessive and Rikers is in real trouble today. So it's got to be fixed. But is it a model for other cities? Absolutely. No question about it. The idea is to get them when they first get arrested. Get them when they get first. And once they're in, you start to talk to them about a future and what can be and what steps they're going to have to take. And then they have to agree to take those steps.
We want to mention your book one more time. It's From Madison Avenue to Rikers Island, The Making of a Social Entrepreneur. Mark, you do some amazing work. And I think one of the most important things is you do such amazing work when you don't have to. And that is also another sign that volunteering within your community, sometimes in the toughest of ways, is the most rewarding thing you can do.
There's no question about it, Peter. I get more out of it than they get out of it. I don't have a bad day at GOSO. The satisfaction I get for having to see these young men achieve. We're having a book party this afternoon up in Harlem, and I only talk for about 2 or 3 minutes. I bring the guys in. I call them my co-authors because in the book, five guys' letters to me, I'm kind of like a father and a grandfather, but five of them actually, they wrote to me when they were in upstate prisons, sometimes as long as 10, 12, 14 years. And then they eventually get out, get jobs, own businesses, and become happy guys with wives and with families.
It's an amazing story indeed. Mark, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you, Peter.
Mark Goldsmith, founder of the nonprofit organization Getting Out and Staying Out, and the author of From Madison Avenue to Rikers Island, The Making of a Social Entrepreneur. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0666, and you'll find links to the Getting Out and Staying Out site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order Mark's book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on The Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter, plus Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com is back on the show to talk UFOs. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more Stuff File news right here, right now, so let's get right to it. The Admiral Ocean Inn in Belfast, Maine, called police shortly after midnight to ask for help by removing a drunk man from its property. Police had ordered the local man away a few hours earlier, telling him that if he returned, he would be arrested for trespassing. When officers arrived, the man couldn't be seen, but it was quite apparent where he was. There was an outline of a man under a blanket sitting on a chair on the inn's porch. Sure enough, under the blanket, they found Philip Delude, and he was arrested for trespassing. Well, clearly, Philip Delude was completely deluded. Even if they couldn't see him, they could probably smell him. It's interesting how, when people are drunk, they immediately seem to have the object permanence of an infant playing peekaboo. 9 teenagers were cited for criminal mischief after several Sarpy County, Nebraska residential fences were broken. A neighbor of one of the victims shared surveillance video with the Sarpy County Sheriff's Office that shows several cars pull up next to the fence. The teens got out of their vehicles, talked for a bit, and then most of them ran into the fences. The group then got back into their cars and left. Sheriff Sergeant Blake Routon said the teens may have been inspired by the Kool-Aid Man. You know, the character known for smashing through walls on TV spots to bring Kool-Aid to children.
Hey, Kool-Aid!
Oh, yeah! Kool-Aid's here, bringing your fun. Kool-Aid got thirst on the run. Get a big, wide, happy ear to ear. Kool-Aid, smile!
Oh, I spent too much of my childhood hitting that high note. Anyway, Routon went on to say, it's unfortunate that they think they have to do this because it's fun or they're having a good time. But what they're really doing is destroying property of people who are working hard to provide for their families. Yeah, well, most kids outgrow it. Then again, some of them grow up to take long-distance crotch shots at a water tower.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
You know, his name always sounded like a pay toilet to me. No charges are expected after an accidental shooting that happened inside the Effingham County, Georgia District Attorney's office. One of the assistant district attorneys, Matthew Breeden, shot himself in the leg while showing another ADA, Ian Heap, his gun. Heap, in his office, mentioned plans to purchase a SIG model P320 handgun. Breeden reportedly told Heap that he was currently carrying that model of gun, but when he went to pull it out of his holster, the gun fired, shooting Breeden in his upper right leg. According to the report, ADA Brian Deal rushed into Heap's office after the shooting. Breeden reportedly said not to call 911, but Deal called 911 after Breeden turned gray and started grunting and drooling. Investigators with the Effingham County Sheriff's Office formally requested that the case be rendered inactive. Breeden's gun has been returned to him. And by the way, according to Georgia state law, it is legal for ADAs to carry firearms in the office. You know, it must be difficult to work or live in Effingham County because when you tell anyone where you live, they must automatically assume that you have some kind of beef with pork products. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, U.S. Border Patrol agents asked the Canadian Pacific Railway to stop a train they spotted with a stowaway in Michigan. Once the train was stopped, they were able to arrest the 33-year-old suspect who had allegedly snuck into the U.S. on top of the freight train that had just come through a mile-long tunnel from Windsor, Ontario to Detroit.
Come ride the little train that is rolling down the tracks to the junction.
The man was also wanted by London, Ontario police for possessing an illegal weapon and was turned over to the Canada Border Services Agency.
Forget about your cares, it is time to relax at the junction.
Well, he can forget about his freedom. Said Chief Patrol Agent Robert Danley, it is extremely dangerous to enter the United States illegally, particularly through the train tunnel. Well, the authorities really threw him a curve.
Lots of curves, you bet, and even more when you get to the junction.
Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program. Dr. Bruce Olav Solheim is back on the program. We had him on the show last year when his graphic novel Snark 2 was released. Well, he has a new one out, and this one is called Dr. Jekyll Alien Hunter. Bruce is also a history professor at Citrus College in Glendora, California, and he joins us via Skype from Glendora. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for once again being on the program with us.
Sure.
When we spoke to you last year, you were doing or releasing Snark 2, which was obviously a follow-up to Snark.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have a whole new story. What's the difference between putting together something that is already a sequel to a successful project before and creating something new like Dr. Jekyll Alien Hunter?
Well, it's actually derived from Snark 2. So one of the characters in one of the stories, or a couple of the stories in Snark 2, was Dr. Jekyll, Dr. Henna Jekyll, who's a anthropologist from Cleveland State University. And she gets hooked up with Snark and the Cosmic Staff in Snark 2. This is a spinoff. And I love the character. So now she has her own comic. And it's a little different take. The style of it is different. I have a different artist. I have a 19-year-old woman from Poland, from Krakow, and she's the artist and gives it kind of a, dare I say, like a female touch to the character. It's different than Gary Dumm, who's been doing comics since the 70s. So it's a different style. It's a little different. I mean, there's still history there. There's comedy, there's science fiction, fantasy, all that stuff. But it's from a, kind of from a female perspective. I think it's cool because, you know, Dr. Jekyll is not a superhero, you know, not an alien, but studies aliens like her father, kind of following in her father's footsteps.
So at what point when you were writing Snark 2, did you realize or think about the possibility of spinning off this character from your previous graphic novel?
Yeah, it just, you know, sometimes you get a character that you want to add to a story, and it just seems to make sense. This is a fascinating character that I want to dive into a little bit more. You know, there are some female comic book characters, but most of them are like, you know, superhero types or whatever. There's, you know, very few that are just normal people, academics, and in this case. And she's also a person of color. Her mother's from Jamaica. Her dad is from England, or at least from the British Isles. And it's kind of a unique thing. And I just enjoyed the character, and it's really rounded out pretty well in her comic. We get to explore a lot of paranormal sites here in the United States, and it's going to be all around the world eventually, kind of like Snark.
At what process in the writing of a graphic novel do you actually engage with an illustrator? And the reason why I ask that is I'm just wondering if any illustrations, be they early in the process or further on, do they in any way, shape, or form affect what you write?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you can do anything, as the late Harvey Pekar said, you can do anything with words and pictures, but the style has to match the type of character, or the type of story that you have. And in this case, it very, very much did. And, you know, I'm a frustrated comic book artist myself, so I do the rough sketches and kind of put together the panels and then give it to the professional illustrator, whether it was Gary Dumb for Snark or Julia Kazanowska, the young Polish artist. And then she just brings it to life, and just she has such an eye, just like Gary. And for a young person, I'm just very surprised how advanced her skills are. But then the story really comes to life, and I might make some edits based on what she's doing with the character and how she portrays the character. Yeah, so it really goes hand in hand. It's really a very much a symbiotic type thing for me.
Why the change in your digital artist, and how did you go about finding Julia?
Well, part of it was necessity. Gary was very busy, so I'm not his only guy that he illustrates for. And then I got to find somebody else just for this project. So I like to publish at least one comic book a year. That's kind of my goal. And Snark 2, although it's all written and everything, it's just, you know, that's not ready yet. Snark 3, which is actually Gary's going to do that. But I just happened to be on Instagram, and just by pure chance, I saw Julia had posted some of her artwork, and I go, oh, that is really something special. I have quite an eye for comic art, and I saw that, and I go, there's something unique here. So I contacted her, and we worked it out and had a Skype call like you and I are doing, and we figured it out, and she gave me some rough sketches, and I go, that's it. She is the Dr. Jekyll artist.
So tell us the story of Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter. What's it about?
Okay, so her father, Dr. Henry Jekyll, her name is Dr. Henna Jekyll, was an anthropologist at Cleveland State. So she grew up with this academic father who studied ancient aliens, and she got into the family business. And then her mother passed away while she was very young, so she was being raised by her father. So she's raised in a very academic environment. When he passes away, she takes on his job, actually. She becomes a tenured professor at Cleveland State. And then she does the same thing. And she discovers what he called the holy grail of his ET research. And she just slowly begins working through it. Some of the stuff she knew, some of it she didn't. And so there's some mysteries there. And she just visits paranormal sites and has adventures with aliens and slowly comes to understand a little bit more of what's going on. And she also faces some pressures like from Hollywood. There's a particular story in there where an agent sees her at a UFO conference and thinks he can somehow package this as a show or a movie or something. And she goes to Hollywood, finds out what that's all about, and rejects it and goes back to Cleveland. She's an interesting character. She's very down to earth. She likes to, she volunteers at the YWCA and helps young women who are recently emancipated, you know, that are orphans. She's just a kind of a cool person. She doesn't have any superpowers, but she's super smart. And she's, that I guess is a superpower. And she's very tenacious, and she has a great sense of humor. And so, yeah, it's a fun character to work with. She does have a sidekick, like Snark had the cosmic staff, but her sidekick is her cat, whose name is Stanley. Actually, his full name is Dr. Stanley Livingston, but, you know, that's a kind of a literary joke, but She calls him Stanley.
Speaking of literary jokes, you just sort of usurped my next question, and that is, you created this character in Snark 2. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to give her a surname that is steeped in literary history?
I've always, since I was a kid, I've enjoyed the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And then I thought I'd put a little spin on it in that if you, and this is for you and your listeners and everybody else who's, well, people who are listening will understand, but if you were to take the name of J. Allen Hynek, you know, the guy who was on Project Blue Book, the scientist.
Right.
And in an anagram, you can come up with Henna Jekyll. So that's how I got her name.
Actually. Wow.
And I love anagrams. And sometimes you come up with some really cool anagrams. You just start with J. Allen Hynek, and Henna Jekyll. That is a real name, you know. So that's how I got it. So now you and your listeners have the secret to the name.
That is a deep dive.
A deep dive, yes, exactly.
Now that you've expressed that point, mm-hmm. I'm sure there are anybody who has read Snark 1 and Snark 2 and who's going to read this, they're probably going to go back to your first graphic novels and see if there's any other Easter eggs that they may have missed.
Oh, sure. Yeah, there are, some inside jokes, some of them that in Snark that I came up with, some that Gary came up. Gary is, it's funny, Gary, the artist in Snark 1 and Snark 2, he kind of is like the cosmic staff, and I'm kind of like Snark, but we kind of inhabit those roles. We're the personification of those roles in real life, but he is quite a joker. So there are little things in there, like Dr. Stanton Friedman in real life, who lived in Canada. I think he was Canadian. He was quite prominent in the ufology community. He died a couple years ago. I reverse his name, and he's used in Snark, so... Yeah, there's little things like that. You know, I like to play around with names and different things that happen. But yeah, that's part of the fun. And this actually, this book, Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter, is a prequel to Snark. So this is what happens before she actually meets Snark and the Cosmic Staff.
How can one get their hands on Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter? Where is it available?
It's going to be on Amazon. So just, look up Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter, or my name, Bruce Olav Solheim, and it'll be there the end of this month. So we're putting the final touches on the last story, the graphic novel, and it's, or you can go to my website, BruceOlavSolheim.com, and you can see all the other things I'm doing on the Snark 1 and Snark 2, which are also available on Amazon. Yeah, Snark 3 will come out probably next year, and then I have another project after that. I got projects lined up.
Congratulations. So yeah. since this is a spin-off prequel to Snark 2, would you say that Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter to Snark is the same as Better Call Saul to Breaking Bad?
Well, that's a very generous comparison, but yes, it's similar in that sense. Yeah, and I love that show. It's in some ways I like it better than Breaking Bad, and that's saying a lot because I do love Breaking Bad.
Okay, so now I have to ask the question: do you like Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter better than Snark?
I guess you always kind of like the thing you're doing right now, and it's not that I like it better, but it's just, I'm really, my wheels are turning with it, and I'm actually starting on Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter number 2, starting the stories anyway, or the, what I call the mock-ups, or I guess they're kind of like storyboards. Maybe storyboards would be a better description of what I do that I give to the artists. You know, whatever you're working on, it seems to be your favorite at the time, but in actuality, I like all of it.
Well, congratulations on your wheels turning and the new graphic novel Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter. Thank you for being on the program with us once again, Bruce.
Thank you, Peter, and I'm wearing an Expos hat right now in your honor.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Dr. Bruce Olav Solheim, author of Dr. Jekyll, Alien Hunter. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0666, and you'll find links to Bruce's site. Also, his previous graphic novel, Snark, has been turned into an animated series. You'll find the YouTube link to that on our page as well. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Available on Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and just about every other way you stream audio. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's everywhere you want to be, and some places you don't.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about UFOs, plus we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, but we have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now. In the UK, in Liverpool, 32-year-old Jonathan Lewis was doing repairs in the house he had just bought when he broke through a wall with a hammer to get a closer look at an electrical outlet. Instead, he discovered an old child's toy, a rag doll with wool braids, sitting staring at him through the hole in the wall. The doll had a menacing note tucked under its little fabric arm. It read, "Thank you for freeing me. My name is Emily. My original owners lived in this house in 1961. I didn't like them, so they had to go. All they did was sing and be merry. It was sickening. Stabbing was my only choice of death for them, so I hope you have knives. Hope you sleep well." Despite the date on the note, Lewis is quite sure the doll was put inside the wall during a kitchen renovation that happened 4 or 5 years ago. He has said that the paper the note was written on doesn't look particularly aged at all, and he finds the incident rather amusing. He said, "I'll be honest, I found the whole thing hilarious. I'd probably do exactly the same thing." His friend's response was to tell him to put the house back on the market and flee at once. Yeah, if you're going to stay in the house, perhaps caution may be a good move. May I suggest only plastic cutlery? In Florida, a Pinellas County man who called 911 to say President Joe Biden needed to be placed in jail was arrested himself. 29-year-old Jacob Philbeck of Palm Harbor was arrested for calling 911 dispatchers several times to say El Chap needed to be freed from prison and President Biden needed to be placed into prison. Dispatchers told Philbeck his comments were a non-emergency situation and he was asked not to call 911 unless it was an emergency. Shortly after, Philbeck called 911 again and talked with a call taker about the exact same issue. Deputies were then dispatched to Philbeck's home, where they asked him why he called the emergency line for a non-emergency, and Philbeck told deputies, "El Chapo needs to be freed, and President Biden needs to be placed in prison." Well, at least he's consistent. Philbeck was arrested for misuse of the wireless 911 system to report a non-emergency and a non-criminal matter. Deputies said Philbeck called the 911 phone line approximately 3 times within a 1-hour time period. They also say alcohol may have been an influence. Folks, don't drink and phone. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com, is back here to share his story for the month of May. This one goes back 70 years to when flying saucers didn't attack Seattle. Mark joins us via Skype from New York. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. So we're talking about something that didn't take place?
Yeah, something that didn't happen this month. But it's kind of timely in an interesting way. So, yeah, it's a UFO story that did not happen in 1952, in May of 1952. And just, I know that sounds odd, which is what we're all about, but just for a little context, 1952 was an especially busy year for flying saucers. Flying saucers, of course, the term came about in 1947, just 5 years before that, when Kenneth Arnold first reported seeing a bunch of them over Mount Rainier in Washington, and it became a thing. Roswell happened shortly after that. And, you know, the Air Force started looking into all these sightings and so forth. But then 1952 just became, there was what's called a UFO, a flying saucer flap. A lot of sightings, hundreds a month. The biggest one being in Washington, D.C., going over the Capitol in July. That was a pretty big deal, you know, on radar and everything. Project Blue Book started, kicked off like the end of the year and kind of began in early 53.
And for those who don't know, Project Blue Book is...
Project Blue Book was the Air Force's study into flying saucers. There had been a couple of preceding groups that they had and kind of changed the name, but evolved into Blue Book, which lasted till 1969 and researched over 12,000 cases and had, I believe it was over 700 left as unidentified or unknown, which is certainly curious. So lots of stuff going on about flying saucers. And so when a major blast occurred over Seattle one early morning in May, and people did not blame flying saucers, that made news.
Wow. Okay.
How could this not be a flying saucer? So basically this blast, you know, was like described as rumbling the city like a freight train. A giant, what they called it, an eerie blue-white light kind of took over the sky, looked to be several thousand feet in elevation. People could see it from 60 miles away. And so, you know, it was certainly mysterious, certainly odd and bizarre. People said that there were fireballs kind of plummeting to the ground. It felt like the kind of thing, given the era, that you would immediately assigned to a flying saucer or some sort of alien attack.
And it was also way past the point that Orson Welles would have done a radio drama about it.
Yeah, but, you know, not too long after.
Exactly.
Maybe still fresh in a few memories, right? So it was just sort of a strange thing. And typically, you know, all the headlines would have said, you know, are flying saucers attacking Seattle? What's going on? Have the Air Force involved? It becomes a Blue Book case. All that kind of thing. And I think there were a few people who did sort of scream flying saucer right away, but that wasn't the major headline. Scientists stepped in pretty quickly on this one, and it was widely accepted that it was a meteor that had exploded and disintegrated as it entered the Earth's atmosphere. So that made sense. That actually explained it, and people were like, okay, yeah, that seems pretty viable, seems like a good one, and they can move on. But like I said, the fact that it was accepted to not be a flying saucer made it worthy of a headline. And I have a headline in my Weird Historian article that says, what? No flying saucers? And the reporter wrote at that time, he said, no one theorized that the mysterious blast which rocked Seattle was a flying saucer that had been shorted by a little coffee spilling over and had so exploded. And he also noted that no one suggested there might be a rocket ship from Mars, which, you know, people still had some thoughts that there might be intelligent life on Mars, even by 1952. So this was all important news that something major could happen and not have aliens to blame for it.
Hmm. By the way, speaking of Mars, I know you've written about it. Your last book, by the way, is Chasing Ghosts, a tour of our fascination with spirits and the supernatural. But a book that you did before that dealt with Mars And weren't you recently involved in talking about your book?
Yeah, I was just at the Explore Mars Humans to Mars Summit in Washington, D.C., talking about early beliefs in intelligent life on Mars, intelligent beings, and all the various theories that people had, early scientists, people from Nikola Tesla to Marconi, Professor William Pickering at Harvard, lots of brilliant people and their theories on intelligent life on Mars and how we might contact them and receive messages that they believe they were sending here to Earth.
Hmm. And did the week go well for you, or the time period go well for you?
It was a great talk. It was great to talk about Martians.
Yeah. See, when
did not attack us.
When you said you were going to Washington, I just had assumed that you were going to be going to Washington to testify about the UFOs because they're talking about that these days.
Yeah, I wasn't able to join the congressional hearings, but interesting timing that we're talking about this story right now. But yeah, the congressional hearings just happened earlier this week, which is, you know, nothing major came out, but the fact that it's happening is pretty exciting, that it's being taken much more seriously by Congress and they're looking into it. You know, the main concern is that we have these Navy pilot, you know, these aviators who are seeing things. And it's everything has been really destigmatized now that they're being encouraged to report, whereas before they kind of felt like they had to keep it quiet. But they're seeing things that they can't understand what they are. And there's video from some of the cameras on these aircraft, you know, very expensive cameras and very expensive aircraft. And no one can really figure out what some of these videos are. I mean, people have probably seen some of the Tic Tac video that's out there, that, you know, three videos were released by the Defense Department a few years back. But they don't know what they are. And so that becomes a real Department of Defense problem, that we don't know what's in our airspace. So they're looking at it now as a, you know, it's a national defense issue.
What do you think it is?
Ooh, well, that's a good question. I'm very curious. It is very odd that no one has a solid explanation for what these things are in the movements that they describe. Basically, the speed at which they're able to move and elevate and descend, and the fact that there's no visible propulsion system is very odd. You know, I've talked to various people about it. Some people in the science community say that it's either could be some artifact of the technology, which may be possible, or some physics that we don't understand yet, which also might be possible, or, you know, is someone visiting with superior technology? It seems a little unlikely that it could be foreign powers. And if it is, that's actually maybe more concerning, because someone would be therefore much more advanced than we are. And that could be a little scary. If it's aliens, they haven't attacked us yet. So it's probably, you know, something seems to be okay in that respect.
Hmm. Well,
we haven't been wiped out.
Getting back to Seattle in 1952. Do we know if any fragments of said meteor or whatever was falling from the sky have ever been found?
You know, I would imagine that the meteorites, you know, various meteorites were found from that after the fact. The story I have was pretty much following the event, like a day later. So I don't know if there would have been follow-up stories reporting on evidence of small meteorites found, but I have to imagine that people, you know, came across a few here and there, I'm sure. Based on the description of what happened, it seems pretty likely.
It's the idea that someone would write a headline saying that they weren't attacked by UFOs would be similar to someone saying in the obituary section of a Detroit newspaper that this was not a murder.
It's a real sign of the times, right? this is what was happening at that time, and it's weird when something like this, when the lack of something happening becomes a bit of news.
Mm. Fascinating indeed. People can always go and find more information by going to your website at weirdhistorian.com. Thank you very much, Mark, for being on the program with us once again.
Of course. Thanks so much, Peter.
Mark Hartzman, author of Chasing Ghosts, a tour of our fascination with spirits and the supernatural. His website is weirdhistorian.com. And you can go to my website at thestuffwild.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0666. And you'll find the link to Mark's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's that time, boys and girls, the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
36-year-old Michael Goldberg from Los Angeles sold meth on the dark web under the name Drugs R Us. Goldberg purchased drugs from various sources and then shipped them internationally using UPS, DHL, and the United States Postal Service. Goldberg, his 33-year-old wife Danica, and 43-year-old James Cukor weren't sneaky, and the authorities first figured out something was up in 2018 when they discovered several parcels intended for the Philippines were full of methamphetamine. Goldberg shipped them under fake names, but used a phone number registered to his real name. Is that what makes him this week's idiot? Oh no, just wait. After the cops arrested him, Goldberg continued to run his criminal empire from a jail. He made numerous phone calls to his wife, often using other inmates' phone lines to discuss drug trafficking, destruction of evidence, and the movement of currency. The cops, of course, recorded these phone calls, which is why they knew his dark web store's name, Drugs R Us. Here's a quote. "So, they got every last thing that we sent. That's crazy," said Goldberg into an unsecured line while sitting in a prison. Now why, oh why, do you think you can continue to run a criminal drug ring on the dark web via phone from prison? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0666. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0666. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including kdxradio.com, truetalkradio.com, streaming on Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, WLSLLPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, CFMU in Hamilton, CKLU in Sudbury, and local 107.3 FM in St. John. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.